From the recesses of space. Gotta get right into it this week because this does happen on occasion, I guess, or this is the first occasion of it, but our chat went a little bit longer than usual. We're really getting into it with Heather Wright and Katie Sanders are back this week, and as you know, they're pursuing their PhDs in cancer biology at UC Irvine, so we're going to get right into it. We're drinking some homebrew from a friend of theirs, and I think we talk about that, so we'll get right into it. And before we do, you can find this information on the internet, you probably already know it, or on the Space Cave, but Rob Crow, who did the theme song, has a new project, new band, and a new tour coming out in the spring called Rob Crow's Gloomy Place. There's a little bit about it at thespacecave.com, and like I said, the internet at large, so hopefully we'll get to leak some tracks from that coming up pretty soon, and you'll go see them, because they're great. Well, I think that's about it. Let's get right into it. For drugs.
Ice cream.
So you were saying that, well, first of all, we're drinking this. It feels good to drink beer with no labels, no cap, you know, like those, nice? Those great like copper caps and home-brewed Bach-Tran.
Bach-Tran, yes. He's my friend who brewed this. He has a pretty good history of brewing. Everything he's made so far is pretty good, except for one batch that was really watered down. But this is supposed to be kind of a clone that he tweaked a little bit himself of Pliny the Elder. I don't know if you've heard of that. So it's an IPA. It might be a double IPA. I can't remember, but it's really good if you want to look for it at all. It's available at some liquor stores, I guess. It's kind of hard to get. I don't know. Yeah.
Oh, that was a good endorsement. It's available at some liquor stores.
Yeah. Sometime.
Might somewhere. Be able to
okay.
Get it.
Piney the Elder?
No, Pliny.
Pliny.
Like,
Pliny.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it tastes piney to me.
It does. It's like I think
trees.
It's the hops. Okay, I don't know.
Probably.
Bach would know.
It's a little hoppy. It's got kind of a... I don't know how to describe beer well enough to, it's kind of malty maybe, that I don't know if that's the right term, or, you know,
I don't know,
I mean?
If an IPA is supposed to be malty.
Herby?
Yeah, I don't know.
Herby?
Yeah.
It's good.
Yeah,
it's
good.
Smooth. It's, yeah, that, anything like smoky. I don't know how I would describe beer.
Yeah.
Other than to compare it to other beer. But yeah. If you like IPAs that are not so hoppy that you know your breath is just going to smell horrible, but it's still got a little bite to it, then that's what I like. I like really kind of the least hoppy of IPAs.
Yeah.
And this is probably a notch above that, but which I still like. So I would imagine this will please all people. Like people like me that... Like you know, IPAs, but not quite the people that are like hop heads, you would call them. Like really like really stinky kind of. Is that a term?
Yeah, let's call it one. I like
right.
it.
I like beer. It. Nice work, Bach-Tran. You
yes,
said that
you
left it out like kind of getting a little warm.
Yeah, I wasn't supposed to. He said it was done. He had it in the fridge. And then I brought it home, and it just was in my room for a day or two. And then I told him that, and he was, like, cringing. So I put it in the fridge. So I don't know if it tastes different than it's supposed to, but it's still
but it's good.
So.
One, at some point, I'll get a brewing expert in to talk about it because, like, I have friends that'll do it with CO2, and they'll have the big wort and, you know, the high temperature. And mm-hmm. I did it with a kit and a little pot when I brewed it the one time. It was good though, and it's fun to sit there and listen to your own
it's
beer
fun.
Kind of bubbling at night and wait for it to be right. It was awesome.
What kind of beer was it supposed to be?
So mine was supposed to be a Pilsner, and it was close, but I didn't cap them very well. I had one of those red kind of the generic cappers they give you with a kit, and I just, you know, it feels like it works really well every time. You like put it on and yeah. clamp it down, but you're really supposed to kind of go all the way around. And so the bottles that I did that with tasted really good. The other ones where a little bit of air was seeping in, it tasted like dishwater. It was horrible. And so I had all my friends over like, we're unveiling the beer, man.
Oh, no. And then,
like, you know, even the people that had the ones that were supposed, that were good, were so repulsed by the people who were spitting it out. That they were like, I'm good, man. And then, so I just went through and opened all of them and was kind of sniffing them. And then I'd go and like, here, try this one. And so
yeah, that's
like,
never a good sign.
No,
if someone's sniffing your drink to make sure.
But it made so, I mean, like 70 beers or something. And yeah. in the end, we got to drink probably 30 that were good. So it wasn't a complete
waste.
Yeah,
and you made it yourself.
Yeah, it felt good.
Fun. Yeah, my husband brews and it's fun to watch. It's weird that it's basically a giant tea bag that you're like steeping tea, but then it becomes beer. I don't know.
Yeah, see, that's what I'd like to know. The way I did it, it was just like pouring ingredients in and the whole thing, you know, all the yeast settled to the bottom. And so like when you siphon it out, you got to be careful because the bottom, and even like a lot of brewers, like sometimes in bottles like these, you don't drink the very bottom of it because like there's still
that's
a
where
bit,
all the,
that dead, I don't know, yeast, if it's yeasty
is.
Or whatever. Yeah. Like, I liked it though. And this is tasty. Yeah. And I think this is, I don't know, just doing this show for a while now, I like the, you know, the both episodes or both parts are fun, but it's I've noticed like in the second one it's fun that we've had a beer together and so like we're a little more familiar with each other.
Yeah.
And we've already been talking about cancer, so
yeah. we're, can only we're pretty, go up from here.
Yeah, yeah, we're not strangers, we're not tiptoeing around anything. And what questions do you get asked most frequently? I mean, when you tell people what you work on, do you say specifically, like, I'm trying to cure cancer?
I don't think I've ever said that.
No, I don't think I'm very graceful in telling people what I do.
Why?
Yes, you
kind of stumble around my words. I'm like, I tell them about the protein I study, and they don't care because they probably don't know what a protein is. A lot of people are very confused by the concept.
Yeah.
So
that's a very selfless, and that's probably the best way to do it, just bore them to tears. And then they walk away going, oh, that sounds terrible. And then all the while, when you win a Nobel Prize, they, go, they were curing cancer.
What? I thought they were studying stupid protein.
So what do you say? I know like the email, and thank you again for reaching out. I really appreciate that.
Yeah.
And I hope more people do that. It's the best way to know people are at least invested and want to be here. But you said that you're studying you guys are pursuing your PhDs and you're working on research that'll lead to, not necessarily to the cure for cancer, but just studying
improved treatments, hopefully. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's what most cancer research is aiming for. But again, it's your little piece of the puzzle that you're doing, and hopefully you can help in some small way.
Yeah.
But yeah, I usually just start with saying, oh, I'm studying microRNA in lung cancer, and that usually ends the conversation.
Yeah.
You would think that, I mean, people go to runs, and they like to cry a lot, and they like to say, get strong, fight it, and they like to do all the, but people don't really like to talk about it or learn about it, or, I mean, even like a conversation like this, I feel like is totally worthwhile, and there's nothing necessarily like taboo or...
I wonder that though, if people just don't, I mean, we are kind of removed when we're in the lab, you know, because we've all known people that get cancer, that's why we do it. But day to day, we're just studying proteins and DNA and, you know, kind of removed from it. But I wonder if, friends or people just kind of do end the conversation because it is kind of a touchy subject and everyone, you know, brings up memories and stuff.
Exactly. And I feel like there's not really a place for emotions when you do stuff like that. So it's a little, I don't know, it's tricky. When you do research on it, you're not, you feel kind of, detached, and people get emotional.
Yeah. I mean, detectives in working with sexual abuse victims or people that are around these sorts of subjects that, hey, don't, as comedians, you know, we run into that all the time, which is, I wish you wouldn't talk about that on stage. And then, you know, people, for whatever reason, there is a propensity for a lot of times for comedians to want to do those jokes. And I think that's where it comes from. It's like, we should not be just avoiding things as if that's going to help. We should find creative and articulate ways to address these things so that we're all aware of it.
I mean, that's why comedy is so great because, you guys talk about stuff that normal people don't want to talk about because they just want to be protected. But it's like, I think it is freeing and nice to hear people talk about it candidly and openly. And
yeah,
I think there's a use for it. I mean, it's easy to look at it like, what are we doing? We're just getting up there and doing a little song and dance so people can. But when you do, you know, when people, I like when I'm at a show and someone does that, I feel like this is worthwhile. I'm glad they're addressing that. Or
Just talking about it, period, and or putting interesting spins on it or looking at it different ways. It's
But I think it is interesting. Like, I like telling people that I study breast cancer metastasis and that metastasis kills 90% of cancer patients. It's the cause of death. And then people are kind of like, oh, okay, well, that's cool. Moving on. You know?
They don't want to know more?
No, because it's, I don't know, it's like, that's what you do. It seems important. Now let's go do something else.
Well, we heard from Katie last time as far as like what got her into it, but I don't know that you shared what led you into this. Just also a love of cells and molecular biology?
Yeah, so my background is in chemistry, and I got like a minor in physics, and I'm just very interested in the biochemical reactions that happen inside your body. It's kind of chaos. And I know in the email I sent you, I mentioned Kurt Vonnegut and how busy everything is. Yeah. And because it is really beautiful to me how in your cell, it's so densely packed. People think of cells in your body as kind of these fluid sacs that have a nucleus somewhere floating around and like a membrane holding nothing together. There's nothing inside of it. But the reality of a cell is that it's so densely packed, and there's this really beautiful symmetry or like order that happens inside of pure, what seems like pure chaos. And so it's just very interesting to me, all of that, the signaling that happens in your body so that you can lift your arm so your muscle can contract and things like that. I'm just very interested, in cell biology.
Have you figured it out? I mean, the nerve endings and how it all works together, and you above most people would have the best working knowledge of here's what happens. Here's how I'm pointing my finger. What is going on? The amount of things that are interconnected there.
Yeah. It's insane. But yeah, you could describe like why you can point your finger that way, which muscles are moving and which bones are bending.
All right. So everyone listening, we'll all do this. Take your left hand from the shoulder, what bone is this?
Don't ask me.
The humerus? Is that the humerus? So your humerus, which is your bicep basically, going straight out from your shoulder. Then your other bones, the forearm, the
radius,
ulna and radius.
Ulna,
yes. Going straight up. So, and then you're taking your left index finger and just moving it a bit. So what's going on there?
Well, the basics of it, I guess, is it's a series of potassium and calcium channels firing away. So it's kind of like your brain, you know, where you have the what is it? Where you're charging your neurons, sending things down. Yeah, the action potential, sending things down the axon. So the same thing happens in your muscle, and your muscle cells are actually like very, very long, multinucleated things, where normally cells in your body are just like, dink.
But these are long cells.
Yeah, they can just, when they divide, they can just become kind of like coalesce to like their divided cell can become them. So they just kind of keep getting bigger. And it's the same thing where it's just action potentials down your arm. It's all salt gradients and everything.
So have you, I mean, it probably on mice, but have you worked on cadavers at all? Have you seen these cells and everything in action? Not in action, but in a real
zombie
form.
Cadaver. No, I mean, a cat in high school.
Whoa. Similar cell structure though, so elongated and all that.
Yeah.
I mean, what are your thoughts on things like fate or, you know, how evolution sort of took place is baffling, that from this like amoeba, prokaryotic and eukaryotic cells and bacteria and all these things integrating into. It's almost like we talked about last week, like where cancer seems to have a goal of some sort, where you watch it. We were similar. From the amoeba state, wanted to move into something, not really knowing what that was, and then maybe evolving like an eye and going, now I can see. now I gotta get that mouth figured out. And then you get a mouth and you're swimming through the water and you're a fish, and then each stage beyond that. And then at some point, from mammals and primates to humans to in the womb to somehow this architecture and this genetics, writing all this code on these chromosomes saying like, someday that person is going to want to move their index finger like this and they can do it. We've written it in there. And how do you feel about that? Like, yeah, just the notion of fate or a creator? I mean, what are your thoughts on that? Well, that's a big question. That's a lot of them. Maybe take it.
Yeah, I mean, it's endlessly fascinating, I think, just how that could have all happened, how evolution happened. I mean...
And it's hard for us to see because we're just this micro piece in it. You know, we're kind of the end result of a long, like, millions and millions and years of evolution that we didn't see. So it's a little hard to grasp.
We're kind of in the forest, and I apologize for putting that huge thing on you guys. And now
no,
go.
No. It's, I mean, yeah.
I mean, but everyone's thinking that. We're all, I mean, to some degree, on some intuitive level, I guess, we're all kind of wondering, because we are moving in that, in a direction that we're unfamiliar with, or where is it trying to go toward this future where we are looking maybe at the genes of embryos and sorting them out and having the best of what's available? Or is it going to revert back? People, like, apocalyptic movies are really popular.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I always think about that, though. And I think it's very weird that we evolved to sentience and consciousness, and that we're aware that, like, we will die someday, like I said on last episode. I don't know why I have to go there.
We're just, like, you keep bringing
so
up
aware
death
of our mortality. It seems a little cruel that evolution turned, like, became that, to where we realized that we did evolve into what we are. It's very weird.
But maybe that'll drive the next step in evolution.
Yeah,
because there must be a reason for it. I mean, mutations happen, accidents happen, they prove beneficial. Mm-hmm. Our consciousness could be an accident, and
that just kept.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
it's like your own life. You don't know what's going to happen in the future, and then you look back and you go, well, yeah, every single thing happened, and I ended up right here. I can't imagine it really going that differently. I mean, I can dream, what if I had done this, what if I'd gone there, I'd be the president. You know, everyone has these kind of thoughts of, I would have such a different life if I had just chosen maybe these one or two steps differently. But your life in the past has led up to you and who you are. We feel that way with humanity too. Like, it seems purposeful. It seems like, oh, like, of course the fish crawled out of the sea, of course they wanted to get on 2 feet, of course they wanted to, like, build cars that could drive themselves. But why would they want to know that they're gonna die?
Yeah,
it just doesn't make any sense.
Be aware of themselves, or
I guess just because it increases your chance of survival, maybe you protect yourself more, you're aware of death, you're more careful.
But there is a book just published called Neuroscience or Neurobiology or something, and it explains how like the way that we perceive the world is not the way that everybody perceives the world, right? Everything is comes down to chemicals. So whatever chemicals are firing in your brain at the time that you see something is going to be forever ingrained in your memory. Is like, that is what you're going to associate it with something, right?
Yeah.
So it's like prisoners that that can get parole, I guess. The judge that can grant them parole is more likely to give them parole if they've eaten lunch before they see that prisoner.
You know?
So it's all a chemical balance inside their brain. It's like very, so like our consciousness still is a work in progress. You know what I mean?
Yeah. But, and then that makes me though think then about fate and destiny, and like if I had just had my hearing scheduled a little later in the day, I'd be free. The judge would have eaten. I know it.
Not too late though. Not before happy hour.
Yeah. But I think I see that more rather than fate. It's more just like randomness.
Yeah.
Which
that's
is kind of scary. It's like, oh, yeah.
When you
luck can come down to luck, and
that's how I always think about it. And I, you know, you see a car accident that, and then you think back and go, I hesitated for a second because I wondered if I'd left blah 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 in the house, and then I left. And if I had left 10 seconds ahead of that, I'd be that car. There was a runaway T-bone accident that no one could have prepared for. That's randomness. Mm-hmm. And yet when it starts favoring you and you're not in that accident, you start thinking like, I don't know. What do you think? I mean, how do you, we have this consciousness not only means like we can know that we die, but it also has thoughts like that. And we're trying to perceive. And then
on top of it, we have morals. The person that got in the accident, we want to go help them. Mm-hmm. It's very weird. A sense
and then
of
we have
community.
Different morals though, between people. Complicates things.
Who knows?
Yeah. What are your thoughts on that? Not to get too far away from cancer research and just the notion that the cancer is always kind of out there lurking, and you're trying to live your life and you're trying to not under the auspice or the assumption that, well, I'm going to get cancer or I'm going to die, but just like, I'm going to try to, while I'm here, I don't know why I got here or how I got here, but I'm going to try to enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at that and you're trying to go out and pursue some of these things, I guess, like, how do you... I guess, I don't know, look at the fates or destinies of those things, or I don't know. I kind of lost my train of thought there. Not fates and destinies, but just that, like, you don't want to die.
Mm-hmm.
You know you're going to die. You don't want to. How do you put that in the back of your mind?
Yeah, I think it's hard. I think it caused a lot of anxiety for me when I was growing up, and especially kind of finishing college, you know, undergrad, and being like, okay, now I'm just part of the world. I had a lot of anxiety, but then you just kind of realize, you know, yeah, this is your one ride, and you can enjoy it, or you can be anxious all the time. You know, you can worry about cancer all the time, or you can just hope for the best and
yeah.
and move on.
Yeah. I like remembering how big the world is. And sometimes, have you ever heard of Perryland?
Mm-mm.
It's in Greenland. It's like very far north towards it faces the Arctic Ocean. And there is this place, this glacier called the Elephant Foot Glacier. But I like looking at it and remembering, if Martians landed in Perryland, they would think the world was uninhabited. And then you remember how tiny and minuscule you are. And it's kind of awesome. You're like, yeah. I don't have to worry because, I don't know, I'm part of
there's a whole
thing.
Giant yeah, yeah. universe and galaxy out there.
It just kind of takes me away from my life.
Yeah.
And reminds me that there are bigger things.
It's the same thing with cell biology going the other way. You can
yeah.
look into the body, all the cells, look into one cell and how complicated it is, how completely complicated it is, and know that, you know, what's going on in there is happening in all these cells, and yeah, and...
And then it's just too chaotic, and you're like, ah,
just be in
I feel
awe
better.
Of it. Yeah.
But something looking through a huge microscope from the ends of the galaxy or the universe looking at us would feel similarly about, like, there can't be anything in there enjoying being in that cell, all the chaos, and that it's part that those things get to be a little bit ethereal, like, man, what if in the cells it's all a little world
yeah.
and they have consciousness in there and they don't know where they are. I mean, we extend beyond that and kind of go, well, I mean, it's the kind of a prevailing notion nowadays, it seems like, for people to go, like, we're not important, we are these inconsequential byproducts of whatever it is, the Big Bang and evolution, mm-hmm. and somehow consciousness accidentally happened. It's a different world it's a different world to walk through than someone who's devoutly religious, because at mm-hmm. least then there are some tenets and kind of parameters, like, mm-hmm. here's why I'm here, and this is special, and there's something definitely to be taken from that. Mm-hmm. I mean, are either of you religious, or have you been or were raised that way?
No.
I did get a little religious in high school.
You got really, like, you weren't raised that way, you just sort of leaned toward it?
Yeah, I think I went through, like, a lot of stuff with my family and everything, and then I started going to church, and then I got really into it, and I started evangelizing.
Your own?
No, with the church, but I went to, like, Argentina.
No, I mean, like, you're yeah. just yeah. went to an evangelical church.
I raised money for myself to go to Argentina to do these things.
What?
I know. And then...
And you had previously been fairly secular and, like, a science yeah. kind of kid.
I don't think I was ever... I wasn't really a science kind of kid. I was really into art. I used to graffiti and stuff. I had, like, a tagging name.
What was your tagging name?
Harmony.
Not intimidating.
I know.
Oh, Harmony was here.
Ooh. I actually did have a lot of penises spray painted over my stuff, so it really wasn't intimidating. Yeah, and I did that, and then I kind of came out on the other side, and it really helped me, I think, like, through the hard times, but then now I'm not.
What yeah. were some of your, like, I'd love to hear you even evangelize? Is that, like, yeah. giving a sermon? What was your cadence? What was your tone like?
I don't know, because it was also I don't speak Spanish that well.
Hello, Argentina. Yeah. I don't speak Spanish. I raised money to get myself here to give you this message in English.
Yeah.
Let's continue.
And I had this little Rubik's Cube that had pictures on it, and I would open it up, and there's a new picture, and then it was very weird.
Harmony is giving a service in English. This is incredible. That's really driven of you, and that's quite an accomplishment. What were your parents thinking?
My dad was just like, you know, do whatever you want.
Oh, sweetie, our daughter, Heather's going to Argentina. Yell at them about what type of, you're really into the Lord. It was like Christ-based, right?
Yeah.
So do you wave goodbye to that?
Yeah. Because, I kind of got into it because the message is really nice, right? You're like, oh, grace, some person is forgiving me for everything I've done wrong. And that's great because, you know, everybody wants to be, I don't know if everybody does. People want forgiveness sometimes. So, and then I wasn't really thinking about, you know, the Bible is kind of this ridiculous book.
You didn't think about that.
I didn't think about the Bible too much. And then like when I got back from Argentina, I started thinking about it.
I hope you have this conversation on flights. Oh, I used to be in that religion, but I forgot how ridiculous the Bible is. Anyway, what's up with you? Do you want my peanuts?
Well, there's a story that my friend told me about today where these little kids are making fun of an old man for being old. And then they all, like the end of the story is they all get killed. It's like a Grimm's fairy tale.
Yeah, I noticed that a lot in that. I've tried to read the Bible once, and there's stories that no one ever mentions or they aren't popularized. And then you're reading, I'm like, what? Yeah. What is this? Yeah. It's insane.
Yeah. Yeah. Their interpretations can be really interesting.
Yeah.
And then I thought, you know, oh, Adam and Eve, I don't know about that one. I don't know about a lot of this, actually. And then I was kind of like, okay, bye.
That was it?
Yeah.
Just as calmly as you had stepped into it, you stepped away.
Yeah.
You know, wow, that is a strange chapter in life.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, how about this? In like the Matrix, us being like our consciousness actually being sort of like a figment, a fictitious thing that we think we're perceiving. That I think I'm touching this table. I think I'm looking at the both of you. I'm really not. And what if death is like a team that are aware that, not necessarily to say like the Matrix where your body's being harvested or something, but the longer you are here, the worse it is for you in some other context. Mm. So they are sent in to rescue, like we say, like, oh, the good die young. Like the death squad from above, the death team would kind of look at it and go, we got them. We got them out of there ahead of time. Unfortunately for this last one, they were 75. It took us a long time, but we finally got them out. And the joke is kind of on us that we're experiencing life and thinking we're so fortunate to be here. And in reality, like when you die, you kind of snap to and you're in your real consciousness, which how could you trust it then? Because then you'd think, well, I'm going to be zapped out of this one too. And I'm zapped out of the next one. But if you could, do you go through that when you're dealing with things like cancer and when you're researching it? Do you look at it like, maybe there are like philosophical components to this that it's not just purely evil and purely bad?
I don't know. I think in that scenario, if you're the one still alive, you don't care because you're still here and you're still, you know, dealing with what you're dealing with here, which usually is trying to live as long as you can. Mm-hmm. And so in our reality, it's like, okay, let's figure out these things like cell biology and genetics and stuff. But I don't know. That would be really interesting if,
So I'm surprised there's not a religion about that or something.
Well, isn't that kind of, you're going to go to heaven, right? It's not, right? You're saying that it's something better after you die. That's kind of like heaven.
You're going to be with the death brigade. That's how I understood it.
Yeah, something like that.
Well, they're going to take you, but they're going to take you somewhere better, right? And that's why the joke's on us, because we're still here.
But then what if they have to come get you? Like, you can't take your own life. They have to come get you. Maybe there'd be some tenets of this stupid religion that we just thought of.
So there's a different dimension for suicides.
Maybe, yeah.
Okay.
This is sounding very religious, right? I mean, I didn't grow up religious, so I don't know, but sounding like heaven and
well, I mean, what do you think? You know, there's an ecosystem, and mosquitoes have a place in it. And then for us as an organism, I mean, we are trying to do what so many species are trying to do, which is just proliferate and move. And then the fact that, I mean, cancer is kind of hard to kind of pinned down as to it's us, it's mm-hmm. our genetics making a mistake. So it's even though we want to look at it like this third party, this mm-hmm. thing, like, oh, it's the thing that wants to take over. It doesn't want to have 7 billion hosts that are all cancerous, that are just these walking tumors that wouldn't benefit cancer. So how do you end up looking at it like as sort of an integral part to an ecosystem or an organism?
So I don't know, because if you think about the planet, and I feel like you've said this before, how like humans are kind of like an infection or something.
Oh,
like
sure, yeah. The humanitis, yeah.
Yeah, humanitis, yes, exactly. So then inside of the humans, there are their own globe, kind of, and they have all of these residents, mm-hmm. and all the residents start overpopulating, right? So it's kind of, I guess, how I view cancer.
I think of it as, person by person is their own little ecosystem, and then a little part of them just, mistakes happen, and a little part takes over, and,
Does it seem like the Milky Way could be a living, breathing thing? We just can't perceive it. It's like an ant looking up at us, and we're a part of it, and Earth is starting to be a little bit malignant. We are the agents of this tumor, which would be heterogeneous. It would look very different wherever you took a biopsy. Maybe that's an alien abduction. They're stabbing us out. I'm like, these ones are the different color than the other ones.
I look at it a little different. I think that's an interesting point, but I think it's more like us, the people and the Earth are all a thing, and we're all evolving.
Mm-hmm.
We're all part of the same thing. We can't go anywhere. Astronauts can, but the Earth and all the people are kind of something that's evolving, and so maybe we're not evolving in a good way with environmental problems and stuff like that. But I kind of think of it as one organism in itself,
I think there are two thoughts there. Not to say that there's like a rebuttal to that, but I do think that it's easy for us in like kind of the Native American sense thing, like Mother Earth, and it birthed us, and the conditions are perfect. But it's also like if we evolve to the point where we're removing our genitals and storing our reproductive matter and we're really advanced, we might potentially at that point also have the ability to like, let's send this reproductive material in little capsules mm-hmm. out into space. And when they find a new planet, they will reach this exact same point where they'll say, man, everything really worked out great. They could be metabolizing arsenic. It could be totally mm-hmm. different, and yet they'd go, what a beautiful world. And there's just sulfur fields and it's disgusting to us. But to them, I think about that when they're like flies that love to be on feces. And to them, like that planet is like, take it in, boy. This is where I was raised too. And one day you'll die here. I want to be raised right next to you. And for us, that's a disgusting planet. But for them, they love it. So I tend to agree with you. I think that Earth is us. Like, we are a part of it, and we kind of, to some degree, started working together at a similar point. Mm-hmm. It took us a little while to get here from the ocean, which still doesn't make sense. How did the bacteria get in there? Just from flying by on an asteroid or something?
But theoretically, evolution started as nucleotides or something.
Yeah, I think the prevailing theory is like some molecules or some atoms were in a pond, some pond scum, and lightning hit and it caused some nucleotides that could somehow self-replicate, and then it got more and more complex from there. But or who knows, or something came over on an asteroid, or I don't know.
It seems like a petri dish or like an entry-level science kit, and the Big Bang is just kind of that. Some sort of, like, the creator to me doesn't have to be something that was even purposeful or just mm-hmm. kind of, but the ingredients are so, they're so amazingly accurate for us to end up where we are, having consciousness. Yeah. But then again, why
things so like unlikely. Any of this is just so unlikely. You think about, lightning hitting a puddle and that sparking something that led to us. It's just all so unlikely.
Yeah.
But that's the kind of beauty of it. That's what's so, wonderful about it, is that, we don't know, and we have our best theory. Maybe that's our best theory, and I mean, it's awesome we can even try to think about it and figure it out, and we're probably wrong, but maybe we'll get more information. That's like kind of the scientist thing. Then you get more information, you refine your hypothesis, and I don't know, it's fun to think about though.
Would you want to know? Like, you're in the midst, you're looking in on these cells, and you're pursuing something. Mm-hmm. And if someone tapped you on the shoulder and said, hey, here's the answer, would you, you'd want to know for sure?
Yeah, I would. There's always going to be more problems to research and more things to try to understand.
What if it was like a unified theory, though, of the universe, and they said, here's the answer to everything, and the part you're working on is critical. It actually explains a lot of it. Here's why there is cancer, and it's a fundamental part because of this, and so on. And then it just continued for not a lot, like 3 pages, and it was all summed up. You'd read the whole thing?
Yeah.
Yeah. But then it kind of seems like it's destiny or fate or something. So you're a part of it, and you can't really control, but you're already contributing to it, and you can't control what you're contributing because you're already doing it. I don't know. You know what I mean?
Like folds
so
in on itself?
If you stop contributing now, that's what the equation said.
So oh, right. Crap. Yeah. So there is a fate component there.
Yeah.
It seems like you subscribe a little bit to that notion of fate. Like, as soon as you stop, that was your life, and that was meant to happen because you did, it stopped.
I don't know if I believe in fate. Okay. I think it's very random.
It'd be hard to be in the science world and have, I don't know, superstitions yeah. or things like that.
Well, and especially going through, like, a PhD program, it's like, there's, you know, you have to work hard and do all that, but it's also, there's a component of randomness and luck. You know, you have, some people are in the right place at the right time to discover the structure of DNA or whatever, you know, it's like a little bit of both, but I don't know if that's fate or just that combination of being prepared and
yeah,
getting lucky.
Yeah. I know, if I had started, I went to community college before undergrad, and if I had just gone
did
into
you
undergrad,
do any evangelizing there? You'd already hung up your spurs.
Unfortunately, not. That was my cross country phase or chapter. Yeah, I hung up the cross and put my running shoes on. But yeah, if I had just gone straight into undergrad and then gone to grad school, I wouldn't have met my PI because I was her first grad student. We met each other when she got there, and I would be in somebody else's lab, and my life would be totally different.
Yeah.
So there is like a very weird feeling about that. And then I'm assuming it's the same for you. If you had done something different on one day, you wouldn't have gotten to do stand-up that night or something. You know
oh,
what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that, you know, the like you would have eventually, though, continued. And, like, fate can only, maybe it can bolster things or expedite them or skip you ahead a level. But if you're headed in a direction, I mean, people will, in the odds of, or in the face of overwhelming difficulties and obstacles, continue to go that way. Even mm-hmm. if it's fate going, turn around, you're not a good singer, just quit for the love of God. That person will just keep going to nightclubs and lounges and singing for a decade. And maybe one day they finally get a break and it works out. And people go, they always knew they'd make it.
But to me, that's not fate. It's more just like your own drive or just doing what makes you happy. It's like
yeah.
if you enjoy singing, even if you're horrible, you just do it because that's what you like mm-hmm. every moment. And I think that makes me feel better about when hard things happen or being, you know, worried about what's going to happen in the future. It's like, well, everything that's happened, you know, the good and the bad has led me to where I am now, which is, you know, great. And, you know, you just got to continue down that path and trust that you'll be okay, you know, even though we are all going to die. I pointed out.
Thank you.
Well, I have a friend who, for a calendar year, if not two, really battled breast cancer. Heather, your line of work. Mm-hmm. And, like, before, you know, hours and hours of chemo and double mastectomy. And, I mean, it's rough for so many people. Mm-hmm. And, but a lot of times at the end, they do run into this sort of, I have this power now. I understand, like, the frailty of life, and I appreciate it, and I feel stronger than ever. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if that, say, that singer had the first night audition for someone that was right after lunch before happy hour, seen them, been in a good mood, and signed them to a deal, and they went nuts, and it was great. They might just go, oh, it's easy. Like, I can, mm-hmm. you know, Teddy Pendergrass, right before he got in his accident, was, and I saw this on a documentary, but like, he had like 2,500 people at a sold out venue and was backstage with his manager, like, I'm not going out, man. I'm not going on stage. And his manager was like, dude, these people got babysitters. They drove mm-hmm. across town to see you. They paid their hard-earned money. They dressed up. You cannot do this. And he's like, nah, I'm just not feeling it. And his manager was like, dude, this, you're going to get the worst karma imaginable, which is such a strange thing to say to someone mm-hmm. who then gets in a terrible car accident. But to that level. Like, if that singer had gone through that phase where they got noticed that one night, they might have that same feeling of just kind of like, it's easy. The person who grinds away for 10 years, or to a lot of people, cancer can be that thing. Like, man, you really should appreciate life. Because if when you're laying in a bed and you don't know if you're going to live another month, how can you not look at it as such an unbelievable gift? Or it's easy for us to say that, and then you have bad days, and you're just like, "Nah, life's this planet's horrible."
Yeah, I think that is a nice thing, is going through so many trials. Like, it's not like grad school is a trial, but it is very difficult. You get criticized quite a lot.
Oh yeah, one of the nobody's main nice. Things you have to figure out is how to deal with failure.
But then you really appreciate constant. When you leave lab, you're like, I'm a person, and this is just a portion of my life, right? So, and for cancer patients who do have to go through things like that, it's kind of like, what else can you throw at me? Because I am like, I can take it. I don't care anymore. You know?
Yeah.
Kind of like, I don't care about the mortality part of it. Yeah. It's just like, I want to experience whatever.
That's interesting though, for you guys, and that, like, there's not, you know, the general public isn't looking over your shoulder going, how are we coming along with that cancer cure, you guys? Mm-hmm. I mean, you're working on a part and you go to these conferences and you might run into people that are working on similar parts. But do we need a united front? I mean, where is cancer research making, you know, so you said things like certain blood cancers, or we're making strides all the time, but it is like putting out a lot of fires. It's mutating, it's changing. How do you guys feel about, like, the odds, our chances of actually getting a leg up or getting ahead of cancer, or at least catching up to it maybe?
Yeah, I think we're doing the best we can. So, yeah, we've broken it up into little manageable pieces that each lab can work on a different piece, and then we can come together and collaborate and, yeah, make strides forward in that area, and then translate that to the clinic. I think that might be a place where we need some improvement, is just getting and I think it's happening, but getting kind of the basic scientists that are working on the details more in touch with, like, doctors and MDs doing clinical trials to make things smoother. And I think that's improving, but I know, like, with some of the stem cell trials happening at UCI, that was a problem, is kind of like translating the basic research to a clinical trial and making sure that the clinical trial is done in a way that makes sense based on the basic research. Sometimes that gets lost, you know. You know, a scientist will work on this whole project, and then one little piece of that will get, you know, translated. But if you don't think about all the other parts of that project, you're not going to do the clinical trial right. So previously, I think a lot of clinical trials were just done like, okay, let's just try this drug on all these people. And, you know, instead of, you know, getting the right people in the clinical trials, making sure you understood the dosage and stuff like that. I think that's an area where we are improving, but where there could be more improvement, the kind of connection between the clinicians and the scientists.
As far as an organized front, so like I mentioned, I think it was last episode, there are common mutations among a different variety of cancers. So mostly epithelial cancers that happen in, like, your breast tissue, your prostate, your kidneys, or whatever. They're called carcinomas. So they tend to have like 4 or 5 very common mutations, and the biggest trouble that we have right now is that we don't have amazing therapeutics for those 4 mutations because they're so tricky. So one of them is like it doesn't matter what it is. One of them is a protein, and we can't figure out how to get into the portion of it that's mutated, right? So it's just right now, like, people are really trying to work to do that. And I think there is potential for that to happen. And once that does happen, I think it could give patients much better prognoses and stuff. So as far as an organized thing, I think it's possible. And with these, like, 4 common mutations, I just think that we need more research. And a problem with that is that people, like the public, they don't know about basic research. They just see like clinical trials and drugs and like what drug can I have, and so they only want to give money to clinical trials and people getting better. Yeah. But you can't be successful in the clinic treating people if you don't have the basic foundation of signaling pathways and mm-hmm. all of this petri dish work. So it is really, really important for us to keep doing basic science so that we can have better clinical trials. You know what I mean?
Nice. Yeah, I think when I lost my train of thought earlier, I was juggling a few too many thoughts, but one of them was like with not necessarily clinical trials, but like you said, like, you know, that's what people know and trust, and medication, and tying that in with like kind of fate and things like that are predictive measures. I guess they recently figured out, they had a number of electrodes in place in someone's brain, and they could kind of map out via an algorithm their thoughts. They could store mm-hmm. at least for a little snapshot their consciousness, every thought they had just had, which is insane to think about, that we could predict or at least store one day of one person's life. Like, here's everything you smelled, and here's how your brain was, you know, activated. But doing that genetically and having a look at how to preventatively, like, optogenetics, we talked about that on Professor Blasoff yeah. once, about like how to really tie into the human body, sort of like a diagnostic system, and be predictive to say like your levels in this are up too high, you're eating this, and or there's a foreign thing we've detected. What do you think is more logical for us to defeat cancer, strictly on a medicine-based sort of path that we're currently on, or is it going to be technology is going to get involved where we do have electrodes or some sort of neurological thing?
Yeah. Yes. Earlier, I was thinking about that also, about talking about diagnostics. So that's another thing that's getting a lot more sensitive is diagnostics, and that's also microRNAs are playing a role in that. So, mm-hmm. you know, right now people look at different markers to see, you know, to diagnose tumors and where they're from and what stage and stuff. But if looking at microRNAs, you can get much more sensitive diagnostics. So I think that's going to be more important. And doing those, you know, having cheap and easy ways to just like, you know, run some blood onto a chip and it'll, you know, mm-hmm. so we can diagnose things earlier. Because, you know, when a tumor is just a small solid tumor, before it's metastasized, a lot of times, like with lung cancer, which is the leading death of, you know, cancer-related deaths, if you remove it before it spreads, you're cured. You could be cured, but yeah. it's just usually found once it's spread. And at that point, it's just way more complicated and harder to treat. So I think, yeah, improving diagnostics and making that a regular part of checkups could be a really good thing, and where we're headed.
All right. So, but I mean, like making them regular, meaning like involving the technology, improving that to do.
Yeah. 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 So there, I work right next to a lab actually. So I do very basic molecular research, and the lab right next to me does microfluidics stuff, where they just take like a very small amount of patient blood, and then they look in the patient blood for like levels of chemicals, certain chemicals and everything. So it's like you're kind of integrating the very basic science with very applicable tests, you know, so they're cost effective and they're sensitive enough to see like very small amounts of certain chemicals or a protein mm-hmm. or a cell or something. Yeah, so probably the logic in trying to outsmart cancer is, yeah, marrying like the engineering, which everybody needs, this basic like molecular research, so that we can find new biomarkers, I guess is what they're called. We can discover new proteins that could give a prediction for how a patient will do if they, let's say they upregulate one protein. We just need to find a really cheap way to detect that protein. Mm-hmm. So it's first finding the protein and then to finding a way to very cheaply detect it, yeah, early enough, trying to get, because like with breast cancer, you have mammograms, right? Everybody mm-hmm. can do those once a year. Cervical cancer, you can do a pap smear. The tricky thing with internal organs, like pancreatic cancer, liver and stuff, you can't just like, you know, screen them.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but if we had optogenetic things like the little cap on the vagus nerve that mm-hmm. could read what your what your nervous system is saying to you, like, hey, your pancreas has a growth, mm-hmm. like almost in an inner yeah. space kind of way. Like, well, everyone's looking around down there. Yeah. There's something weird.
I know, you know, like detecting polyps in your colon and stuff is pretty invasive. So I think they can probably do something for internal organs someday. Yeah.
So the thing that seems the most appealing to me about it is it seems like when we figure it out, we will squash it. We're not going to keep chasing it and battling it and pumping people full of pills. If we have the diagnostics, if we have our money appropriately funded, if we're having whatever that is, like internal diagnostic things that can look at your internal organs and catch it ahead of time and remove it, I feel like then we'll eliminate the threat. Then there would only be the remaining, you're getting old and we're increasing mm-hmm. the lifespan and your cells reproducing or that's not the right term. Your cells regenerating, I guess, is they're getting worse at it every time, every day you're alive. So that's probably not good. So getting old will be the ultimate sort of like, hey, man, you just got old. But ahead of that, do you feel positively like we will figure it out and we'll beat it on a level that's not us just chasing it or like take these pills or how do you guys feel?
Yeah, I think we'll improve diagnostics. So that'll improve outcomes. And I think you still have to find ways to treat, you know, different kinds of tumors, and we'll continue to get more and more specific with different types of tumors and better treatments. I think with both of those, like, that feels good to me. I'll be happy if we just, you know, keep getting better with that. And yeah, like with technology to help us do all these things and sequence genomes and help with that kind of lab on a chip type stuff.
Nice.
I feel hopeful about that.
Good. Well, we got to get out of here pretty quick. You wrote some things down, Heather. What did you
write
down?
I was just tracking the conversation so that when you ask a question, I don't like completely lose track of what we're talking about.
Oh, that's smart. That's a good idea. Yeah. I think I lost my train of thought at one point just because I have so many questions. Yeah. Like, I have so many things. I read David and Goliath, and there's a part in there about the guy who invented chemo. And have you read that? Are you familiar mm-hmm. with that at all? He was born, his childhood sort of prepared him with this weird empathy and a lack of caring for the current state. Like, well, this will be good for you. Just take your medicine, it'll be good for you. And so he was sick of watching kids die, and he essentially created chemotherapy by like, well, this one drug works for this, and this one works for this, and this, let's jam them all together, mm-hmm. hold these kids down and slam it into their bone marrow. Kids are screaming and yelling on the table, and parents are freaking out, like, what are you doing? Mm-hmm. And he was, you know, had, I guess, the foresight to kind of go, this is your only chance. Either this kid's going to die this miserable, slow death, or we can act aggressively and head it off. And then he, you know, revolutionized cancer treatment, yeah. which is still not in a great spot, but well ahead of where it was before that. So
I do feel hopeful about treatments. I think we're a long way away from them, though, because of, what is it, administrative limitations. Mm-hmm. It's really hard to get a clinical trial started. It's really expensive. It's really hard to even get an IRB to work with humans, you know, if you're working at a school. On top of that, and I don't mean to be a downer, but it is part of the very interesting thing about cancer in it being a good example of evolution is that you can treat it with the best drug in the world and you can kill what you think are all of the cells, but there are certain dormant cells in cancers, and say from the primary tumor, it does metastasize, meaning it moves from that tumor into a different organ, mm-hmm. or your bones, your lungs, or something, and it acts completely differently. And so the drug that works on the primary tumor doesn't necessarily work on the metastasis, or it doesn't work on the tumor cell that decides it doesn't want to replicate for right now, so it's just going to sit there for 30 years. And while all the other tumor cells die, it's still just sitting there, and then 30 years later, it's like, bam, I feel like replicating, you know, once all the chemo's gone or something.
It's so flamboyant.
Yeah. It's excited.
I feel that you weren't a downer. I think that's realistic, it's frustrating to think, like, with our, at least in the United States, like, our current situation with healthcare, and I guess it's taken a step forward, and yet it doesn't seem like there's any impetus to create a cure, to eradicate things that we're...
Sometimes, yeah. It's scary to think about that.
It's much more financially beneficial.
Can make more money if they just have a treatment and not a cure.
Yeah, and that's scary. And I think that's why it's hard to get funding for things like involving technology in it. And the drug companies have such a stranglehold where like, hey, we'll mitigate things and we'll keep things in check to a certain degree, but it makes no sense financially for us to eradicate anything. Let's keep our heads about us. And that's frustrating because I think in this, as people, anyone that's interested in science thinks like, but what if, look what we could do.
Yeah, and I think there's enough of those people that just want, you know, so many scientists, you know, good-hearted scientists that just want to help people. And so hopefully those people will outweigh the business people.
So. But I think of like open source software, and I mean, there are a lot of things that people are just doing out of just the goodness of like, I know how to do this and I want to share it. And if you want to donate back, or even things like a podcast, I think like there are things in the world where it's a lot harder to do clinical trials, or especially like developing the technology to build these things. But if someone had like a little kick or a spinoff of a huge, you know, like Amazon or something, like they could work with a limited budget and come up, don't you think like they could come up with something that would go, if you have cancer, you're going to want to put this little chip on your earlobe, you're good. It's just going to like change your body frequency just enough to just vibrate that out of there, or something that stupid. Just that simple would be great.
There is like a big it's very weird, like you said, with companies kind of having a strangle on the market, being because they have all the money, right? You know, donors are, I actually have no idea how they have money. I don't know anything about business, but there is like scientists like academic scientists, they find this really cool thing. They're like, this could be a therapeutic. I need to get a company interested in it so that they can take it and run with it, because I can't, because I don't have the money. So the biggest impetus on research is money. And so it is very weird, because companies are out to make money. If you get a contract for them to look into your biomarker, it's really great for the community. But if they have other vested interests, where who was that who just raised the price of an HIV drug to like an
exorbitant
amount? So it's like they could do real good, but then be butt heads about it.
But that's not always the case. There are companies that, you know, really do want to further medicine, and you know, are doing it, I think, from good places. You know, they still have to make money, but same thing with like academic labs, they still have to make money. You know, you still have to apply for grants and do all that. Like, everyone still needs money. But I think, I don't know, sometimes I feel like people go hard on the drug companies, and it's like, well, but they're all, you know, they're also trying to do good, I think.
Right. Where do you guys see yourselves? I mean, what's next after you complete your PhD program?
I want to keep doing research. So,
yeah, basic research. Yeah. I'm open to continuing on to a postdoc or working for a company.
I don't know if I want to stay in cancer.
What a strange sentence. So it's more about the exploratory element of it to you, as it is like, I mean, it doesn't seem like you hold out a tremendous amount of like pressure and or hope that like I'm going to cure cancer or be a step in getting there. It's
like you go into it thinking I'm going to get a Nobel Prize, but then years and years of research crush that out of you.
I mean, I think you just hope that whatever you're working on will help, whether it's cancer or some other disease. I think we'll both probably stay in like biomedical research, you know, which is ultimate goal is to help people with some sort of disease, whether it be cancer or something else. I think we're both open to. I don't know. We'll see.
Well, I'm rooting for you guys. And again, thanks for dropping by. And Bach Tron, well done.
Yes.
This is great.
Thanks for being here. I'm glad you like it.
Is there a name for it?
No. But if I'll
Harmony.
Ask him. Harmony Ale.
So good. All right. Well, thanks a lot. Thanks again, you guys. Any last things you want to get out there?
Anyway, thank you so much for having us.
Yes.
It was really
thanks
fun.
Thanks for having us.
If anybody is in the Irvine area and they are diagnosed with breast cancer, I highly recommend Dr. Alice Police. She is a brilliant breast cancer surgeon. The whole UC Irvine breast cancer facility is amazing. And I feel for you.
Yeah. Sorry. But I just want to say, if anyone wants to connect, I'm on Twitter @BioCuriousKatie. So
cool. And I'll put that on the Space Cave website as well.
Great. Yeah. Thank you so much for having us. This is a real
treat for us.
Of course. Oh, I'm sorry. One last thing.
Sure.
So this is the Tumor Suppressors. We're a Relay for Life team.
Oh, you're still in the cross country world.
No. Oh, well, Relay for Life used to be running in like the 70s.
Okay.
But now it's more fundraising, I guess. So, but Relay for Life, the organization, they give some money to research, basic cancer research, but then they give a lot of the money to patients. So I don't know, people that don't have cancer don't really know this, but a lot of patients have to travel like 3 hours out of their way to get chemotherapy and stuff. It's very difficult for them. So Relay for Life supports them. They give them rides and everything like that, patient care and stuff. And so, yeah, we have a team at UC Irvine called the Tumor Suppressors, and the event is over for this year, but next year is a long way away. But if you keep it in mind and you want to donate for cancer research,
yes,
please donate to our
team.
Better
than Susan G. Komen.
Exactly.
This will be going to a good cause, and we can prove it.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Katie, Heather, thank you guys. Thanks for visiting the Space Cave.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Well, that's our episode. I really enjoyed chatting with them, and I hope they'll come back. I think they mentioned they're driving back up from Irvine for the Junk Show this Sunday, the 13th. So maybe I will coerce them into doing another chat and having some more beer. And yeah, that homebrew was really good. So I don't know how you can get your hands on it, but I don't know. Email me, and maybe I'll put you in touch with them, who can they can then contact their friend. I'm sure he'd love to brew some beer specifically for you, ship it out to you. Sounds easy enough. So we'll try to make that happen. And if you are in LA, come to the Junk Show. First one back at the Copper Still in a couple of months. It was fun taking it out on the road, but it'll be good to bring it home. This show is compiled, put together by Dan Pritchard. Thanks again to Rob Crow for the theme song. And check out Rob Crow's Gloomy Place. There's a sample track online. I think there's an article at like Pitchfork and a handful of other places. You can get in early on that and go support them. And then we have some more music at the end of the show. Thanks again to everybody who's like subscribed or shared the show or rated it or whatever, all those dumb metrics like on iTunes and stuff. They do help get the word out about the show. So if you like it, thanks for doing that. I appreciate it. And I have albums on iTunes as well. There are three of them. And I have a new visual project that's available on Vimeo On Demand called One Headed Beast. And you can find links to all that stuff at davidhuntsford.com. What else? I think that's pretty much it. So come to the Junk Show. Join in next week. More beer, more chatting. And this has a tie-in with One-Headed Beast, Andrea Hale. Hello, Andrea. Who animated the genetics segment. I don't know if you remember that, if you've seen it. It's cool. It's one of the trippier looking segments of animation in the special. It's real unique and looks very hand-drawn and stuff. So anyway, she's very talented. Her husband also is, and he sent along some music. This is from a project, the band called Common Minor, which I've listened to the album. It's called The Match That Stayed Lit. Really good. I enjoyed it. And this is the first song off of that called Gardener. Hope you enjoy it. Thanks for stopping by the Space Cave. The blue and green road that sits between me and me. We'll be right back.
I can't taste much, and the label.